The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, we're on Amazon Podcasts, we're on Stitcher, we are on other podcast platforms, all under Writers on Writing. You can also follow us on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. We're on Facebook, Writers on Writing. We both have websites, Barbara's Pen on Fire, mine mariestone.com, so you cannot miss us. If you've been listening to the show for a while, if you've heard one or two episodes and you want to either leave us a review or provide personal feedback, we always love hearing from you. So drop us a line however you can. We love it. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. Today is all about the mystery with perhaps one of the most prolific living masters of the forum, Anthony Horowitz. It's said he may have committed more fictional murders than any other living author. And I don't doubt it. The last time I counted, he had penned more than 50 books, including the best-selling teen spy series, Alex Rider, which he adapted into a movie that was released in 2006. The Alex Rider series is estimated to have sold 19 million copies worldwide. For his adult audience, Anthony was commissioned by the Conan Doyle Estate and Orion Books to write two new Sherlock Holmes novels. The House of Silk was published in 2011, internationally lauded as a top title. The sequel, Moriarty, was published in 2014 with similar success there. Most recently, he was commissioned by the Ian Fleming Estate to write a James Bond novel, Trigger Mortis, which was published in 2015. Might have done one other under that title. We can talk about that. But I know him best for his Alan Conway, Susan Ryland books, Magpie and Murders, and now Moonflower Murders. Anthony was on the show with me back in 2017 to talk about Magpie. You can find a link to that interview in our archives. So, of course, I had to have him back on to talk about Moonflower. It's published by HarperCollins here in the U.S. Anthony, welcome back.
Marie, thank you for having me a second time. It's a pleasure to be back.
So I won't even ask what you've been up to since we talked the last time. How many books have you done since we talked in 2017?
Well, as you were introducing me there, I was thinking 2017, I must have written another three, maybe four books since then. Plus, of course, some TV stuff. And Magpie Murders is being turned into television, and I've written the scripts for that. So every year I keep saying I'm going to do less work and try and be a little less busy, and it just somehow never happens.
Well, and in fact, we had to post our chat from a couple of weeks ago because you had two television shows going into production at the same time, and you're both writer and producer on those. Am I to conclude that this sort of frenzy produces generative new material? You know, how do you kind of multitask that many things at once?
I think there is a danger in doing too much. I mean, you know, your show is about writers and writing. And I think that it's something I would say to other writers is be wary of getting into the trap that I seem to have fallen where, you know, deadline after deadline sort of sits in front of me like a mountain range. And why I'm so busy, I don't know. I mean, there are two reasons. The first is that I still love writing. I am passionate about writing. I am only really happy when I have a pen in my hand and ideas in my head. So that's it. And the second thing is I generate a lot of ideas, and I find that ideas, I never write down ideas in notebooks, because if you write them down, I think it's like pinning a butterfly into a case. It somehow takes away the beauty of the idea or the freshness of it. If it's going to survive the idea, it will flutter about in my head by itself. But eventually these ideas demand to be written. And when you have as many ideas as I do, I end up, you know, I can't stop myself. I've got to release this idea into the world.
Well, and your books are very complicated. I mean, we're going to get into Moonflower in a moment, but it's an incredibly complicated book with, you know, two books within a book within a book, a giant cast of characters, a lot of moving parts. And so I'm just curious how you hold, you know, the architecture of that novel is not simple.
You're absolutely correct about that. But when you talk about it being complicated, I mean, the first rule I set myself, the first law of the book is that it's complicated to write, but it cannot be complicated to read. You've got to know, you know, I'm not that bright when it comes to sort of big, thick books with lots of characters. As a reader, I don't like it if I'm reading a whodunit and on page 197, I'm wondering who on earth is this character? Where have I met them? Where were they on the night of the crime? Why is the detective asking these questions? I get lost very easily. So when I'm creating these, you know, quite big books, Moonflower Murders is 600 and something pages, as was Magpie, a book within a book, so sort of double size. My first responsibility to the reader is to make sure that it is easy to understand. You said it's a book with many moving parts, and that's an analogy I use myself. I think of the books as a little bit like a watch, which has all these cogs and wheels, and if you opened it up and looked inside, you couldn't make out head nor tail of how it actually works. But telling the time can be done at a glance. It's an easy thing to do, and that's what I'm trying to do with these books.
So as you're working on multiple projects at once, I don't know if you have multiple books going at once in addition to the TVs and TV shows and movies.
No, I never do two at the same time.
Okay. And in terms of what your office looks like as you're constructing this complicated watch with cogs and wheels, this remains in the architecture of your mind or in the Word document on the computer, or you have notes all over your office walls?
Well, you can tell how busy I am by the state of my office. If I'm in the middle of a book like Moonflower Murders and it's really complicated and I'm jostling ideas, my desk becomes a complete mess of sort of files and notes and notebooks and drawings and scribbles and other books, reference books, dictionaries, the whole works. And the office looks a little bit like the inside of my head, which is to say very cluttered and untidy. But in terms of my working method, I tend to work with a fountain pen or you know, whenever I can, and a notepad. I have a certain type of notepad I like. It's called a Europa, if you want the actual brand. I don't quite know why I like it. They come in different colours, and I find that the colour will suit my mood somehow. And I don't go to the computer until quite late in the process. You know, I try to write the whole of the first draft by hand, and the draft that I put into the computer, which I would call my sort of polished second draft, is, you know, then getting ready to go to the publisher who wants it all, you know, sent across the net. But I like the scratch of the nib. I like getting ink on my fingers, real ink as well. Lovely colours of ink as well. I've got one called Splendid Blue. And I always think when I dip my pen into a Splendid Blue, I'm going to write a splendid book.
I was sort of picturing your office like that scene in The Usual Suspects where, you know, the detective turns around and he's got this board with all of these pictures on it and strings going from one thing to the other. And I thought, this must be what your office looks like.
I tend to stick with a notebook. I have very beautiful notebooks that people give me as gifts. And I like to write every single thing down. So if you take a book like Moonflower Murders, and if you went to my notebook, you will see the entire growth of the idea from where it began to almost the finished product. And what's interesting, I always think when I look at these, is how far I travel from the initial idea to changing that idea, to adding new characters, new thoughts, new clues, new twists and turns, and all the rest of it, and how very different the finished book is from my original thought. And in fact, Moonflower Murders, I spent a lot of time with the character Frank Paris. And I remember that in the first draft of it, the whole mystery was going to turn on whether it was Paris with two R's and one S, or Paris with one R and two S's. And I had this idea in my head that that readers wouldn't spot the difference. You could actually write about a character called Frank Paris, but it would be the wrong character. And I spent months and months with this idea before I tore it up and realized it didn't work and actually wrote the book that you can now talk about and read.
I love that. So the original conception of the book started with the victim instead of with the perpetrator.
They always start with the victim and the perpetrator in one breath. I think all murder mystery to me looks like a dartboard, and the bullseye of the dartboard is two people, or possibly three, possibly more, but basically it is a killer or killers and a victim or victims. And your starting point, actually the real beginning, is one killer and one victim. And you start by saying, here is one person, here is another person. The person on my left wants to kill the person on my right. Why? What has this person done to deserve being murdered? And then everything builds out from that initial starting point. And also the first most important rule for me is that the motive should be something interesting and unusual. I don't, you know, it could be just that, you know, he wants to inherit money. So person A, a boy kills his father to inherit the house. But that to me is too ordinary, too boring, too well-trodden. I look for sort of motives that make you smile, motives that sort of come left field. My favorite motive for a murder, unfortunately I can't reveal what it is without giving it away, is the murder of the woman Diana I can't remember her name, Diana Cooper. Diana Cooper in The Word is Murder, which is the first of my Hawthorne novels, which I think is a really, really interesting reason to kill somebody.
So, you know, I guess we should step back to introduce our listeners if they have not already picked up Moonflower Murders. When we talked last time, I had not realized Susan and Alan in Magpie were going to embark on a series. And I think I've heard you didn't know that either.
It was indeed written as a standalone. And it's one of those difficult things. Again, you know, writers in your audience may have had experience of this, where you write a book that your publishers like and the public like, and suddenly you're getting demands for a sequel, because modern publishing is very much about, you know, characters that you meet and re-meet and series of books rather than standalone. I wrote Magpie Murders thinking there was only one way to do it and there was no possibility of a second book. But then, first of all, my publishers asked for a sequel. But more critically for me, the TV rights sold. Well, as I mentioned, I'm now writing the scripts of it. And the producers desperately needed to know that there would be more than one series in order to raise the finance to get it made. So it became, it's not a good reason, incidentally, to write a book. Economical reasons or vanity reasons are not necessarily a good reason to write a book. But in this case, what happened was I began to think, can it be done? Can it be done? And I suddenly had a sort of an idea, yes, it can be done. The same games, the same twists, the same sort of, you know, book within a book. But I could do it in a different way. And once I found myself smiling at the thought of writing it, I was able to sit down and do exactly that.
And there's an allusion in this book, the Punt books, I believe there are nine. There's a little bibliography at the beginning of the book within the book that indicates there are nine of these Alan Conway books.
There are indeed nine of them, yes.
And does but that suggest?
It doesn't mean there can be nine more books, because first of all, in Magpie Murders, I gave away the ending. Surprisingly, I have actually now thought up a third way of doing the same trick again. And so it's quite possible within a year or two, I might even do a third one. But that will be the end of it, because I think there are only a certain number of times you can take a formula, the book within a book, and play with it before it becomes a little bit sort of self-referential and even dull.
I was wondering how many times. Well, in your hands, I'm sure three. It could be, three. Okay. So to set the stage, why don't you take us in and kind of tell us what Susan and, well, I know Alan has been dead. Alan has stayed dead. But tell us a little bit about them.
Susan Ryland is not a detective. She is an editor working in publishing, and she publishes murder mystery books written by a man called Alan Conway, who is an extremely unpleasant man. They do not have a very good relationship with each other, editor and writer. And a third character in this is Atticus Punt, who is a character created by Alan Conway and published by Susan. So that is sort of the triangle of the heart to the books. And in Moonflower Murders, Susan has actually left our publishing. Alan Conway is dead, and she is living in Greece when a couple approach her, the Traherns, Lawrence and Pauline Traherne, to tell her that 8 years ago, they were involved in a murder. They ran a hotel in England, and on the wedding night of their daughter, a man was murdered. This was 8 years ago. The police have made an arrest and somebody has been in prison now for 8 years. But just a week ago, the daughter, the one who got married, read one of the Atticus Punt novels. And after reading the Atticus Punt novel, she was aware that the wrong person had been arrested, but the police had made a mistake. And it also becomes clear that Alan Conway, when he was alive, had visited the hotel and had used the circumstances of this murder 8 years ago to write his book. And so somewhere inside the book is the solution to a murder that took place 8 years ago, added to which the daughter has gone missing. So there is a need for Susan to come back to England to read the book, find the daughter, solve the murder. And that basically is the story of Moonflower Murders.
The beauty of Susan, many beauties of Susan, is that she is not a detective, and her role in the book industry allows you to do a lot of play. And I remember this from Magpie as well, do a lot of play with writing craft. Like you almost embed your books with nonfiction craft material for your readers. It's wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful for me.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm very interested in using the murder mystery format in different ways, doing things with the genre, which could give an added value. I mean, my first aim is it's pure Agatha Christie. I love clues, red herrings, you know, suspects, and I've already talked a little bit about unusual motives and all that sort of stuff. And of course, surprises. I love to surprise the audience with the revelation at the end of the book as to who actually did it. But on top of that, I just have this feeling that murder mystery can do more than that. It can be about something. You know, for 16 years, I wrote the series Foyle's War on television, which was effectively a murder mystery stories, but I'm more proud of the number of war stories that we told, the true stories of the Second World War, the home front in Britain, 1943 to 47, secret intelligence, and all these other unknown stories of the home front, which are sort of piggyback onto the murder mystery stories. And so in a way, Magpie Murders and Moonflower Murders are doing the same sort of game. In this instance, discussing the nature of writing, the nature of murder mystery. Why is it that a murder in the street or in the family may shock and disgust us, but a murder on the page is entertainment? Questions like this, which I find endlessly fascinating. And after all, I have been a full-time professional writer now for 4 decades, you know, which is a sort of scary thought, but it's what I know about. And therefore, you know, I've got a lot to write about in that world.
It's interesting you bring that notion up about why we tolerate and enjoy and relish murder in fiction when we do not so much tolerate in real life. I engaged in this discussion on social media the other day about adultery, and someone posited that people don't like to read about adultery. And I said, well, that erases most of literature, but okay. But they made the point, but we love murder.
If I may say so, it's quite an interesting thought. There was a TV series in Britain, I don't know if it was shown in America, called Broadchurch. And it was extremely successful and popular. It starred David Tennant as a detective and Olivia Colman. Absolutely wonderful casting and great characters, very, very well written. And the first two seasons were about murders. And the third season was about a rape. And I had this strange feeling that I couldn't watch the third season because it was so, you know, and it made me think that murder, taking somebody's life is makes you smile, and it's sort of, you know, it's fun and it's Hercule Poirot. But somehow rape is so evil and disgusting and horrific and awful that I couldn't enjoy the show as entertainment because it just felt wrong. But again, maybe that was me being ridiculous, because as I say, if murder is entertainment, why isn't adultery? Why isn't rape? You know, where do you draw the line? And I think this is sort of the sort of question that I get a real pleasure out of discussing in the books.
It's a very interesting point. And, you know, the other point was made that we do not tolerate the killing of animals in fiction.
People just close the book.
The biggest sin.
William Goldman in Adventures of a Screen Trader, you know, just if you want to create someone as a villain, just have them walk 3 steps down the street and kick a dog and you already hate them.
Right.
But that's true. It's also true. But I think that, you know, the cruelty in any form is very unpalatable in books. I'm reading a book at the moment called Out, which I would recommend to everybody, by Natsuo Kurino, a Japanese writer. It is one of the cruelest, most violent, most shocking books I've ever come across. And I'm reading it with a sort of a queasy sense of, you know, am I enjoying this? Do I want to turn the next page? But it's, again, so well written. It won many, many awards in Japan, that I am pursuing it. I will go to the end. I only have about another 100 pages. And curiously, the other thing about this book is it is written, Natsuo is a female name in Japan. It is a woman writer writing about graphic violence towards women, which I tend now to avoid in my work because I find it, you know, I think with the times we live in, it is no longer, you know, classed as entertainment.
So what is your take about our tolerance for murder? And in this book, I don't think it gives too much away to say, because it happens very early, the murder weapon is a hammer. It's very personal, very up close, very violent. And yet that doesn't bother us. It didn't bother me at all.
Because there's very little description. I think there's two reasons for this. First is context. Why are the Alex Rider books, you know, so successful when they contain so much violence? The answer is the violence in the context of Alex Rider is cartoon. It's Tom and Jerry. It's lighthearted. It's not real violence. I think that's also true of the violence in Magpie Murders and Moonflower Murders. That yes, if I take a hammer and kill somebody with it, I could describe the scene in terms that would, you know, make you not want to have your lunch. Or to lose your lunch if you'd already had it. But that's not what I do. I mean, the description of the murder is all you need to know. I mean, there is blood and it is unpleasant and people are upset by it, but the reader is not upset. They are. Maybe that's the answer. The characters in the book are upset by it. The reader mustn't be.
So let's go back to this notion of the bullseye. So we start with a victim and a killer. And that never changes for you. You know right from the start who the killer is, and that is a static, immutable for you as writer.
Every writer is different and every writer works to their own rules. But I would say I would find it impossible to write a whodunit without having, first of all, sketched out in a very detailed way the structure of the book, both the motive of the murder, to start with, the identity of the killer, the method in which the killing is done, and all the sort of things that link into it. Because don't forget, you say you start with two characters, but you have already, even when you invent those two characters, the person who is killed and the person who does the killing, you're already inventing two whole worlds. Because it might be that the victim is, shall we say, I don't know, a world-class chef, and the killer could be a construction worker. But there are already two very, very different worlds, and I have to know about them. And in the case of the chef, it's going to mean that you were talking about kitchens and people eating food and money perhaps and Michelin stars and a very rarefied world. The construction worker, if that's the other person in this story, could be incidentally male or female in both cases, could, you know, that to me now means office developments maybe. You know, I'm surrounded in London by cranes and building sites and all the activity that goes with that. And it's another whole world. And of course, both those characters have relatives. They may be married, they may have children, they may have brothers, sisters, they have bosses. So even the creation of two characters actually opens up on the page 500 possibilities.
So it's a book within a book, and you write the books independently of each other, or do you have to write the Punt book completely after the entire first draft of the other book is done?
I think in the planning stages, I'm planning them pretty simultaneously because I am looking for clues inside the novel, Alan Conway's novel, to reflect on the world, the real world in which Susan Ryland lives. And I almost draw up a list when I'm doing this of sort of, I call them ingredients of what sort of clues can I put into the, you know, what is it that Alan Conway saw? What has he done in this book that will lead you to unmask the killer? And that's in the planning stage. When it comes to the writing stage, I only ever start at the beginning and move forward. I know, again, other writers may go differently, but to me, the sense of sequence, of flow, the idea that a novel is a river that has a source and which then runs down to the sea, if you like, that to me is very important to the writing process, that I am going with the flow. So although it may in the second and third draft be necessary to jump back and forwards a little bit and insert a few more clues or change a few bits and pieces that aren't working, the actual writing on the day-to-day basis, sort of the eight, well, for these books, it's about 12 months. The 12 months that it takes to write them is one of moving forward constantly.
I can't recall from Magpie if there would have been any situation where you would have written yourself into a corner thinking, you know, you're writing a standalone, now it's a series. If there was anything in that book you had to navigate around for this book.
Well, as I mentioned already, some of the stories written by Alan Conway, I gave away the ending.
Because there was
no reason not to. Right. It wasn't a spoiler alert. These books didn't exist. But that meant that when I came to choose the book inside the book, Atticus Punt Takes the Case, as it is, which I think is the third in the series, that meant I had a limited choice. And there were other things, too. I wanted, for various reasons, Alan Conway's boyfriend, who's called James, also turns up as the sidekick to Atticus Punt. And for various reasons, I didn't want him in the book, not in the book, inside the book. I wanted James, but I didn't want his alter ego of a sidekick. And that's to do with the construction and the solution. So again, it's difficult to talk about these things without giving too much away. But there were quite a lot of constraints on me from moving from Magpie to Moonflowers. It required careful navigation. And I have to say that I have had one or two people on Twitter saying, hold on a minute, you said this in the first book, and you've now said this in the second book, and good luck to them. But mistakes are bound to arise.
It is funny. I wonder if the reading audience for mystery books is slightly different than the reading audience for, let's say, straight literary novel fiction, because there's almost a contract with the reader where the reader is not just a passive consumer of your material, but an active detective alongside you. And they seem to get angrier about details than literary fiction.
I'll say two things. First of all, I find that the audience for murder mysteries is delightful. That and the writers as well. I mean, you know, there is a real community of crime writers who are often dealing in the most terrible sort of violence and depravity, but are themselves the most charming and nicest of people. And there is a real sense of camaraderie. And I've had a lot of support from the sort of the crime writing family, which I'm very appreciative. I forget what the other half of that, your point was about readers being more critical. Again, there is no genre of writing, and I think this is really interesting to consider, in which the reader and the central character make the journey absolutely shoulder to shoulder and side by side. And, you know, literary fiction, it might happen now and then, but in a detective story, the detective and the reader enter the story pretty much at the same time. They have the same aims, which is to find out who the killer is and to reach the truth. And their journey is one of mutual discovery. And that, I think, is part of the charm of writing murder mystery, that you are next, you know, whether it's Sherlock Holmes or Poirot or whoever it is, you know, you are with them. And incidentally, that's why the sidekick is so important, because, you know, we would not really like Poirot or Sherlock Holmes, for that matter, if it weren't for their wonderful sidekicks, Watson and Hastings, who are, as it were, the sort of liaison between the reader and the detective.
Well, I bring this question up because, and I won't get into the series, but there was a series here in the US called The Undoing, which was, you know, 6-7 episodes. So it was some.
I have seen it, yes.
Yes. You know, I won't give anything away about that either for people who may not have watched it, but the social media debate about the ending of that series was ferocious. And, you know, hundreds and hundreds of comments of people very angry. And I thought this wouldn't happen in any other genre. You know, that people felt deceived, or they felt like they were part of the mystery and they somehow the contract was broken with them is how it
is. Maria, I think you make an absolutely brilliant point. Absolutely excellent point. Yes, the contract is broken. You put your finger on it, because that is what murder mystery writing is all about. It is a contract with the reader. You read, let's go back to an Agatha Christie. You either guess the ending or you don't guess the ending. And either way, you will enjoy the book. But if you don't guess it and you feel that you weren't given enough information to guess it, that is a breach of contract by the author. Or if you read, get to the end, and there is a huge plot hole, that is also a breach of contract, and you become quite agitated about it, because, you know, you read a murder mystery, obviously for the characters and for the quality of the writing, but above all, you read it for the puzzle, for the solution to the puzzle. And so therefore, I can understand the anger that faced The Undoing. I was angry myself because it promised so much. And I think at the end, I don't normally criticize other people's work, but to a certain extent, it delivered too little at the end. The ending was, I thought, disappointing. That said, I had enjoyed the ride, the 6 hours of the show. Beautifully produced, wonderful actors. Great to see Donald Sutherland on the screen. A brilliant little child actor in there somewhere. Hugh Grant, interesting casting. Nicole Kidman. I mean, how many more beautiful frocks can you wear as you walk down Fifth Avenue in New York? It was a wonderful ride, but the destination was disappointing. Right. And I think that's why there was such a kickback against it. And the funny thing is, it would have been quite easy to have done it a different way, but they have adapted a book, and I suppose they were faithful to the book, for which they should be given credit. And it was what it was. But I'd completely get why there was a bit of a kickback for it.
Well, and you put, yes, you put language to it, that I think in this genre, there is a contract that's established that if you break, you will gain the fury of readers, perhaps for a lifetime. You know, if that was a series, I thought people are getting off that train and they're not going to get back on. Let's talk a little bit about your wonderful sense in all of your books of wordplay. I know you're a magician, or you're at least a magic enthusiast. And I believe I've seen a picture of your office where your desk, one of your offices, where your desk is just filled with these interesting collectibles. And I was wondering if there's a way in which you feed your creative mind through physical beauty, objects, whatever, that, you know, if your eyes alight on something. I think the last time we were talking, you said, I'm just staring at something here and I'm figuring out how I can use it in this book. Do you populate your world intentionally with ways that will kind of unlock all of these cogs in your mind to use in your fiction?
Yes, I spend an awful lot of time in a room by myself. And so I make sure that everything in the room stimulates and amuses me and keeps me entertained. And that may be works of art that are, you know, that I can look at and see new things in every time I look at them. Or it can be the little collectibles you mentioned, which are automata. They're sort of little mechanical toys that tell a story and which make me smile every time I look at them. Or it can be just things related to my work, inspirations. A Tintin rocket, for example. I've always loved Tintin, so I have a lot of Tintin material around me. Gifts that I've been given, from you know the James Bond estate gave me a nice little racing car, not the real thing. It's only 6 inches long, but it's still a nice little handsome little model. And you know, I look at it and it reminds me of writing that book and the pleasure that I had in writing it. So everything in my world is connected to sort of fun, but also a lot of objects give me ideas for books. So for example, I have a sculpture by a lady called Ruth Barrett Danes. She's not known. She's not a sort of, you know, a major artist, but I bought a piece by her 40 years ago. It gave me a nightmare, and that nightmare turned into 5 books, the Power of Five series. And the little sculpture that she made is the main character in those books. And magic, you mentioned magic. And you also in your introduction mentioned Moriarty, one of my, I think, darker and more sort of twisted plots. And the entire plot is actually based on a magic trick. I'm very interested in the connection between illusion, magic, trompe l'oeil, and sleight of hand, and murder mystery writing. You know, where as a writer, I'll often point you in one direction, so you won't notice what I'm doing in the other. And Moriarty, it's a very very basic card trick. It's, you know, schoolboy level, but it just occurred to me that it was absolutely perfect construction for a murder mystery story.
Do you practice magic?
Yes and no. I don't ever perform magic because I'm, you know, I look at some of these performers on YouTube. In fact, you know, it's one of my little treats to myself. I've been writing for an hour and I want to rest. I'll either play the piano, which is one thing I do, or I'll take the dog for a walk, or I'll watch a magic trick on YouTube. And, you know, these modern young magicians are so brilliant at what they do, but then they spend 24 hours a day practicing and making themselves brilliant, whereas I'm all fingers and I'm clumsy. But I do occasionally try and perform sleights just for my own pleasure. And again, I find the connection between cards. In fact, my new novel has a chapter in it called The Ace of Spades and involves a playing card. So I find there's sort of a link between the two, which pleases me.
I only bring this up because my husband is a sleight of hand hobbyist. He doesn't do it for a living, but he's done it since he was 5 years old. And we got to talking about magic and mystery writing, and he was making some of the same parallel observations about withholding information, things done in isolation. And
well, forcing a card. I mean, you know, one of the magic begins with card forces. And I know lots of different ways of, you know, spread the cards. You pick one, and I've actually made sure that you pick the card I want you to pick. So that's called a force. And I think that in murder writing as well, you're always doing forces. You're saying to the reader, pick this suspect because, or look at this clue. And that's a force because actually when they look at the, I don't know, the candle on the table, they're not looking at the knife and fork. So I may describe both of them, but I did write them in such a way that it is a candle that takes your attention.
My guest this morning is Anthony Horowitz. The book we are talking about is Moonflower Murders. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You're so wonderful with wordplay. I know there was a lot of this in Magpie. There's more of it in this book. I know you're a crossword puzzle enthusiast, and I don't want to give too many of the the little tricks away.
The acronyms and anagrams and my next book has just had a title thrown out by my publisher. It was going to be called The Deadly Palindrome, but unfortunately my publisher did not know what a palindrome is. A palindrome, a sentence that reads the same forwards and backwards. Madam, I'm Adam. Or my favorite palindrome is a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Which actually is a palindrome that makes sense and tells a little story. I absolutely love it. But sadly, that title was thrown out. So I do love words. I mean, you know, words are my building bricks. Words are my bread and butter. And words are what I spend my entire life stringing together. And I have a sort of a healthy respect for words, not only in their sort of, you know, meaning, but also the sound of them and anything that is quirky about them. Facetious, one of the few words in the English language. I think possibly the only word in the English language that has all 5 vowels in the correct order once, things like that.
Are there sort of internal rules, or is it done by intuition that it doesn't, something like that doesn't feel too gimmicky or too obscure? That, like, how important is it to you that your reader understand what you're doing? Or the corollary, how important is it to you to look at a word trick and say that's too, not cliche, I don't know what the word is, too gimmicky, I guess.
Well, I think there is a danger in being too gimmicky, especially when you're doing wordplay and sort of, you know, things like that. And I am careful to measure it, very carefully, so that somebody doesn't become too noticeable and too much sort of an author showing off.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting is that Magpie Murders has a you know, part of the solution is an anagram. And so everybody was looking for the same in Moonflower Murders. And yeah. Therefore, I had to be very, very careful about what I did and how I did it. I'll say no more than that.
Yeah.
Because again, at the end of the day, you can be hoist by your own petard. If people get to know that you do these tricks, then they will just look for the tricks. It's a little bit like Hitchcock, you know. Hitchcock always put himself into his films as a sort of a little in-joke. But then he very soon discovered that people weren't watching the film because they were just waiting to see if they could spot him. So it became something that was not helpful to him, which is why in most of the Hitchcock later films, in fact, in all of the later films, he always appears in the first minute or two. Get it out of the way.
Right. The thing that I also enjoyed about this book is that the hotel where much of it takes place and part of it and sort of a mansion in the other part, the physical structures themselves felt like characters in the book, you know, and you went to quite great lengths to describe what you had to make the murderer.
Well, again, it's very good you to say it, Maria, and I'm grateful to you because it does matter to me a lot. The big hotel in the book, which is called the Branlow Arms, or whatever, I can't remember its name now, but the hotel where the wedding took place and where the murder happened 8 years ago, I began to imagine it and to write it and to sort of think about it. And I was then invited to a literary festival in Ireland. And this festival took place at a house which you can look up on the internet called Boris House with two R's, Boris House near Dublin. And the moment I saw this house getting out of the car, I knew that I was actually walking in to what I'd been trying to imagine. And this hotel reeked of atmosphere. And it was a hotel, actually, no, it wasn't a hotel, it was just a house. But this house reeked atmosphere. It also reeked of a sort of place where a murder could take place. And two of the things that make it into the book absolutely are the rocking horse in the entrance hall and a thing called a figeen. I'd never heard of a figeen before, but on a shelf on the first floor, there was this huge Irish brooch with a quite lethal looking pin. And it was called a figeen. And I knew that when I wrote my book, I would have to have a figeen in it. It would have to take some part in the plot. And I took the hotel in its entirety, merely uprooted it from Ireland and carried it to England with me and plonked it down in Suffolk, which is where the book is set. And it exists, as you so rightly said, as very much a character in the book.
I'm glad there's a real place because that was going to be my next question it sounds like you kind of grew up in a fairly grand house. And I was wondering if, you know, if your childhood memories ever come to play in your books, if that house ever falls into your novels.
My first 10 books that I wrote as a very young writer are all based more or less on my house, my childhood, my parents, my teachers, my schooling, me as a kid. And it was only when I threw it all out and wrote Alex Rider, my 11th book, that success began for me. I think there can be a real danger in being too obsessed with your own world and your own, your own imagery and autobiography. And actually, you know, Alex Rider was deliberately created to be everything but I am not, you know, in every respect, physically and his view on life and his family, you know, it was a real step away from what I was doing. And that was the book that flew. So although, yes, elements of my childhood, of the school where I spent 5 unbelievably horrible years has featured in 4 or 5 of my adult books and keeps cropping up almost despite myself. I can't seem to get it out of my system. But apart from that, I always use real buildings if I can, but there are places that I have visited. So, you know, I always know when I've come to a location I'm going to use because there's something so special about it. And it sort of just makes me feel emotions rather than sort of visual clues. It's an emotional reaction to a place that will make it sort of sear it into my consciousness. Then I'll take notes and I'll take lots of photographs. And then when I get to write it, it's all there for me.
Do you feel like those first 10 books were necessary to kind of clear out the cobwebs? Was it kind of a long throat clearing? Do you think that was necessary?
Most of them, and this is unusual, are still in print, which is sort of, you know, it's curious and unusual. And I'm not sorry about any of them. I think that they were fine at the time, and they're still enjoyed to this day. Granny, a book about my grandmother, is, you know, I still get tweets from kids who are falling about laughing at this atrocious old woman who caused me so much misery when I was a child. So no, I don't have any regrets about writing them, and I don't consider them directly as sort of a passage to anywhere. All writing, all writers travel down a passage, which is their life's work. So, you know, somebody like Charles Dickens from Pickwick Papers, all the way through to Edwin Drood, is a journey. You can see the wheels turning and the new ideas coming and the thickening and the deepening and the sort of the writing, often, not in his case, but because he was a genius from day one, but often the writing getting better and better as the writer gets more mature. So the writer's passage is interesting to me, and everything you write along the passage is useful and part of the journey. But I didn't consider those first 10 books as merely being a sort of something I had to get over in order to start writing well.
I can't recall if you had formal training as a writer. You're an autodidactic writer, or you...
I have never had any lessons in writing. I've never had any training. I've never gone on a writing course. I read two wonderful books, Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman and On Writing by Stephen King. And they were full of wisdom and you know, helped as a sort of sounding board to what I was doing. I don't descry, incidentally, writing courses. We have a lot of them here in the UK, and many of them are first rate. You know, East Anglia University has produced some very, very famous writers. And there's the Arvon course, which does wonderful work. I've actually taught on it once. So I think writing courses, you know, have their uses and can be very valuable for some people. I never needed them. I sort of was born knowing what I wanted to do and how I was going to do it. Right. And maybe that's why it took me 11 books, you know, and 10 years to get actually successful.
I was going to say, if any of us have 11 books in our lifetime, that's already a miracle. So to get, and you were first published by the time you were 22, yeah? Or maybe even
that's
younger?
Correct, yes. My first 22. Book came out when I was 22.
Amazing. Well, I know you were a born storyteller because you were, you know, I've read that you were telling stories, at least orally telling stories, you know, as a small child.
Cool. That's right.
Yeah. What do you feel is the most, either the most useful part of your personality, whether it be discipline or curiosity or some tool in your writerly trade that sort of is responsible for all of this prolific material and success?
It's a passion for writing. It's an overwhelming, sometimes almost destructive, sometimes quite debilitating love of writing. And the sense that I'm only actually alive if I'm writing.
Do you find inspiration from things you observe around you? Is it like newspaper articles? I think we were talking about this the last time, where you just come across almost anything. I mean, I feel like your eyes kind of light on almost anything and you're trying to figure out how to make a story or a mystery around it. But I don't know if there's one thing that you find that fuels your creativity more than other things.
I'm not entirely sure I know the answer to the question. I can say this. I think that everything has a story attached to it. You know, every object in front of you, how did it get there? Who made it? You know, what is its function? How much did it cost? What could it be used for? What is its secret, if you like? I mean, you know, from a book to a chair, to a picture, to a, you know, I'm just looking around my room now, you know, to the little toys that I've got, my automata. They're all stories of a sort. And what inspires me, I guess, is thinking about things laterally, thinking about what, you know, thinking about things that not taking anything at its face value and finding the story that hides behind it. That, I guess, is what I've always done. It's why I like magic and illusion, why I want to have secret passages in my house, why I think of myself almost as being someone, you know, that everything about me is somehow sort of internal and not, you know, and it's always secret. Secrets have always been a big part of what I'm about. And murder mysteries, of course, are all about secrets.
I also really appreciated about this book how you were, you know, this book was a lot about class, and I don't want to give too much away, but let's just say that it was a lot. There was a lot of subtle discussion and not so subtle discussion of class issues. And I really enjoyed how you could have sort of a, it's not a commentary, I wouldn't say, on our society and how things are going both in Europe and the US, but it was a way it felt for me for you to have some sort of discussion about issues larger than the mystery itself. I don't know if that just seeped in because it was on your mind or if you had some intention behind wanting to have that discussion, but talk a little bit about that, kind of the bigger issues of the world going on and how those can motivate a murder mystery.
If you are writing as much as I am writing, and have been writing for as long as I've been writing, it is impossible to ignore what is happening in the world around you and to respond to it. It's in often in writing itself. I mean, questions of cultural appropriation. I was having a conversation just before we began this dialogue with yourself about the language in a TV script and whether I could use profanities or not, which was to do with, I don't know, it was to do partly with the market, but also with certain zeitgeisty things. And when I look at what's happened in America over the last 4 years, and in England also over the last, the United Kingdom, I should say, over the last 4 years, and you know, as I get older and become angrier, it becomes harder and harder to keep it out of my books. Now, actually, I try very hard to keep politics and to keep my thoughts out of my books, particularly my children's books. I think there's something quite scary about a children's author who is trying to impose his political vision on young minds. I mean, it may be done altruistically and it may be perfectly reasonable thing to do, but nonetheless, I find it slightly sinister, so I don't. In the murder mystery books, obviously I am reflecting a modern world and therefore I have to have an understanding of the modern world and what is going on there. So the fact that you know, if one gets into the sexuality of the characters, the ethnicity, you mentioned the social side of the character, that a man has been locked up in jail largely not because he committed the crime, that much is clear from the start, he didn't. He's been locked up because he is a sort of person society believes should be locked up, which is to say he is an Eastern European and he is poor. Now that is something that you could read in a left-wing newspaper, and I suppose you could accuse me of proselytizing a little bit in the book, but I don't think so. I think it is simply that I am aware of what is happening around me, and some of it seeps onto the page. I mean, you know, as I'm having this conversation with you, I'm also a little bit nervous, because when you discuss these issues, when you lay them bare, like in the James Bond novels, the attitude to women, the attitude to Jews, the attitude to all sorts of things, foreigners, you know, you find yourselves in dangerous grounds, because social media has meant that most conversation is not like you and I are having now, I hope, which is sort of, you know, thoughtful and interesting and exploring grey areas. It becomes very much black and white. This is true or this is true. There's nothing in between. And that's also scary. I mean, you know, I think that the advent of social media on the world is one of the most sort of scary aspects of 21st century life. What it's doing to us, social media, which should be bringing us all together because that's effectively its aim, is actually driving us further and further apart. And I find that sort of, you know, both interesting and something to write about and to be aware of in my books, but also something that frightens me. So it's a sort of a relationship with the real world, which is I live in it, and therefore it's going to end up in some form or other on my pages.
Well, that's such an interesting conversation, because I wonder how much you've been writing for so many decades and how much you feel not silenced, certainly, but constricted or more aware of what you might say in a book today than you might have 20 years ago.
At the end of the day, and this is what I always think, my job is to entertain. People are not buying my books or reading my books to get a lecture about whatever, you know, whatever the debate of the day happens to be. They're reading them to be entertained. Yeah. Also, if I were to mention in my books a hatred for, I don't know, for a left-wing or a right-wing party, I'm carving my readership potentially. I mean, you know, people of the party that I don't like may say, well, you know, to hell with you, I'll read somebody else, thank you. And I have a responsibility to my publishers, I have a responsibility to the bookshops that sell me, I have a responsibility to the readers who like me. To not become a bone of contention, to not become controversial. Now, I have to be honest with you, Marie, in the past, I have made mistakes and I have found myself in the newspapers for all the wrong reasons. I mean, you know, I have blundered rather than done anything particularly malevolent, I think. But nonetheless, it has taught me to be careful. So when I get into this area of a conversation, even with yourself and knowing that this is, you know, knowing where this is going, I find myself now always stopping myself and second guessing and being careful, because, you know, there is no point anymore in giving offense. Yeah. It doesn't help me, doesn't help my books, doesn't really help anyone.
Such a double-edged sword.
It is, well, a shame in a way. I mean, you know, when I was younger, I was much more open. If I, you know, I used to go on TV shows, debating programs and such things. I used to quite enjoy it. But you know, I have a son who works in government, and just that fact alone means that I have to be very, very careful before I shoot my mouth off.
Well, it's interesting. We were just having this kind of a side conversation since we're talking about magic. The Magic Castle here in LA is really under fire for very good reasons. But there is a culture and a tradition, and I'm not defending anything they've done, but it is changing the nature of what that club is. You know, there's a conversation of, anyway, this is hot topic.
I know exactly where you're going with this, and the question we have to ask is, does the writer, even of the sort of the most lighthearted whodunit, have a duty to go with the flow, to promote the new sort of thinking, to champion the rights that 20 years ago were either illegal or were not spoken about? You know, to what extent should a writer be setting the tone of the conversation, or should the writer be hiding under the bed covers? These are, I think, really interesting and pertinent questions. Lionel Shriver, a writer I admire very much, is often and frequently getting herself into trouble of one sort or another for her personal views. And I don't know whether to sort of admire her or to say to her, you know, for God's sake, Lionel, why are you doing this? But I do admire her very much. And, you know, and part of me then says, well, maybe you're rather cowardly to not be doing the same yourself.
Well, that is a whole nother show and a fascinating one. Well, I guess then the sort of parallel conversation is how the world is changing technologically and how that would change the murder mystery. Because, you know, during the days of Sherlock Holmes, we certainly didn't have access to DNA technology, but we've now got drones and killings where no one is even present for the killing, right? Facial recognition drone technology. And we've got Zoom and just all of these ways that I can see this impacting the genre, because the technology is really changing how we're interacting and maybe how we're even killing.
I was writing the script. I had a meeting with the director on Magpie Murders. I had a scene in which Susan came into her house and pressed the answering machine and listened to her messages while she fixed herself a gin and tonic. And he said, "Anthony, you know, nobody has answering machines anymore. Can you please take it out?" And it suddenly occurred to me, gosh, I have got to be careful, but I'm quite an old-fashioned person, and I'm also getting on a bit in my age. And I do tend to think a little bit in sort of, you know, in terms of the technology of the 70s and 80s. And you're right, everything is changing. But that said, all these things will give opportunities for crime writing fiction. I mean, you know, as soon as you wrote down drones, I scribbled that onto a sheet of paper thinking to myself, wow, could I do a murder in which a drone is involved in some way, a drone that can look up and look into a room, a locked door mystery with a drone outside the window? How will that work? And even in some of my other books, again, the word is murder. Cell phones are used very much. The modern technology is used as part of the clues. And Zoom, you mentioned Zoom. I've long thought in all the Zoom meetings I've had over the last 9 months that it would be a wonderful forum for a murder to take place. You've got nine people talking in nine little boxes on your computer, and the top left guy murders the bottom right guy. How does he do it and stay on the screen at the same time? There's a murder mystery to write in that, and I will perhaps write it one day, a murder by Zoom.
There was, in fact, a murder by Zoom. Someone was killed on Zoom over the summer at some point. And to the point about
somebody else taking part in the conversation.
Well, it was on screen, and obviously the murderer and the killer, or the victim and the killer, were in the same room, but it was witnessed by, right, the other people on screen. Well, so not really a mystery.
That was for real, was it? I mean,
that was for real. Yeah.
And I have this idea that somebody is in, you know, one person is in London and the other person is in Edinburgh. And yet somehow the Edinburgh person manages to murder the person in London during a Zoom conversation while they're both on the screen. That's a puzzle that's in my head at the moment. One day maybe I'll work it out and write it.
With the drone, you see.
Oh, well, there you go. Yes, controlling the drone all that way.
I do think the ways in which we are headed killing-wise, you know, there was a Iranian, the nuclear scientist in Iran, right? Or Iraq was just killed that way. And, you know, it's really changing the groundwork, but again, another time, another process for
it's
another time.
Be, you know, there are pitfalls. It's got to be fun, and it can't be stupid. I mean, the trouble is, you know, if you have a drone that hovers outside a window and fires a bullet into somebody's head, and you know that's how it's done the murder. If I read that, I would go hopping mad. I'd rather to say that's ridiculous and sort of, you know. So I think and hoaxy and silly. So I think it's interesting. Using technology is a challenge, especially for the golden age murder mystery writer who wants to, you know, I don't like blood splatter. I don't like forensics. I don't like all that stuff. But some of these things can be used in an unexpected way. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but taking a telephone with your cell phone I've always thought of there must be a very, very interesting murder mystery in which the person who is taking a selfie is murdered at that moment. So somebody actually takes a photograph of their own murder. And that's using technology, because when you take a selfie, things happen that you're perhaps not aware of, which might be useful in constructing a murder and a clue.
It's so interesting, because I would think that having written as many books as you've written, you'd run out of ideas, but it sounds like it just generates more ideas.
Well, it's where we began. I mean, why do I do so much? Because I still have so many ideas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've covered a ton of territory. Are there things we should have? Is there more writing advice?
I feel like because I've got to go and find my dog, who is going to know what he is doing, and get in the car and go off for Christmas for my family, or getting the preparations together. But Marie, may I just say what a pleasure it has been talking to you. It's a sort of, you know, I'll tell you something about murder mystery. You see, it brings people together in a very, very comforting and humane way. And after the year we've just been through, 2020. And the politics that we've seen on both sides of the Atlantic, and the sort of the changes to our life, there is something about murder mystery, its old-fashioned quality, its humanity, that just makes people feel warm. And that, I think, has characterized, I hope, our conversation, and to anyone listening to it, I hope that's what they will get from it.
Well, and if I can make one more point, it also, in a world of misinformation and disinformation, where truth itself is no longer reliable and concrete, this contract that we were talking about that is established with the reader, there's some comfort and reliability in these are the facts, this is what happened, and this is, you know, the result. And I did find in reading this that sort of comfort that you can put your feet on the ground and know it's the ground, and you know it's still playful, and you still don't know exactly what's going to happen, but the facts are the facts, and there was some comfort in that.
Murder mystery is the only literary genre that deals in absolute truth.
You
finish the book with every I dotted, every T crossed, everything is known, every secret has been revealed, and the world is somehow a better place.
Yes. Anthony Horowitz, this was wonderful. And you have a great website. So if people want to know more, or how to buy any of these, or watch any of the movies, it's all there. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this.
And I too, Marie. And I wish you and all your listeners a very happy holiday.
Thank you. You too. That was Anthony Horowitz. The book is Moonflower Murders. It is out and available now. And like I say, you can find Anthony at his website, anthonyhorowitz.com. He is on Twitter. I know he's very active on Twitter, so you can find him there as well. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.